There's two networks, and we're always happy to hear from you.
It's
there's
Central
an issue
time,
you think
I'm
needs
Rob
more attention
with us
on
here
the air,
on the Ideas
Network.
Well,
there are people working
pick
on
number,
it in your part of Wisconsin.
100.
We want to know about it.
Got it?
You could email
chances
us
are
at
good. There's
Central
a healthy,
time,
maybe even
at WPR.
Sports debate
around who owns that particular number. Owns, like, for example,
if there's something
the
you
12.
Want to hear about on a future show, let us know
lots
about
of big name football.
Is there an issue in Wisconsin that you
one
think deserves
who you're
more attention?
Which one?
Are there
best
voices you
wearing?
Want to hear more
to
of
the
on the air?
Of the 12s?
Are there people in your
debates
community
like
working
rise
to solve
and
a problem
stadium
in new
seats,
ways?
Dinner tables,
we'd love
bars,
to hear from
and
you.
Social
you can
media
email Central Time at
our next
WPR.org. Team that's settled.
You can also submit a question through WPR's Why Wisconsin project.
At least for a couple
if you're curious about the state history, culture, or anything else Wisconsin, tell us what it is at WPR.org/why.
You think
why
of that?
You
Wisconsin.
Think of that particular player in sports at whatever level, global,
tell us
across the
be.
Country, or here in Wisconsin. Is this a question you've ever debated with friends or family members? Is there a current Wisconsin player who might own a particular number in the future? And why is it Giannis Antetokounmpo? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Paul Hemakidis, also known as Hembo, is a content producer for ESPN's Get Up. He partners with Mike Greenberg on ESPN Radio's Greeny. They're co-authors of the new book, Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. Hembo, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. This has been as much fun to talk about as we could have possibly imagined. When you write a book, you obviously put it on ice for quite some time. And over the last couple of weeks, as we've been doing things like these, it's just been such a delight to see the amount of interest and opinion that this idea has generated. So it is a delight to talk with you today. And I'm hoping that you and I will find some common ground with these numbers and maybe even some disagreements along the way too. That's part of the fun.
It definitely. And that's one of my takeaways from this book is, of course, these are highly subjective and highly personal things, but the choices you've made are great conversation starters. Was that part of the goal from the outset?
Yes, that is most definitely part of the goal. So I would describe the book as having sort of two pillars, if you will. The first is what you just described, sports debate. Numbers are obviously the vernacular of every sports fan. Whether you are a casual fan, whether you are a passionate fan, you are at least to some degree fluent in numbers. And that has been something that has become exceedingly clear as we have kind of unveiled this idea and talked to fans and readers across the country. But the second half of it is sports history. And that is really what I major in as someone who sort of made his bones at ESPN, first and foremost, as a researcher. That's really what I took a lot of pride in when it comes to this project. Obviously, a lot of these decisions were excruciating. But once we made them, it was my responsibility to drum up the very, very best numbers that money could buy to justify each and every one of our selections. So like I said, you might disagree, and justifiably so, on some of the decisions that we made. But my hope and my expectation is that when you do get a chance to read our book, Got Your Number, at minimum, we can make a defensible case why we chose each of the people in most cases that we chose. And that's the very best that we can do.
And the criteria, you know, you might be comparing a NFL quarterback against a Major League Baseball shortstop. Obviously, you can't take numbers and compare them. Can you talk about some of the things that went into this? Some of it's the statistics, some of it's the significance. And as you mentioned, the place in sports history.
Yes. Yeah, so much of it is the legend of the player. So I'll just throw out a number, for example, and show you some of the excruciating decisions that we struggle through. So especially comparing players across sports, how do you do it? So for example, number 21, worn by Roberto Clemente, worn by Tim Duncan, worn by Deion Sanders, worn by LaDainian Tomlinson. I mean, truly, it's a fool's errand to try and scientifically, objectively, discern who is the person that owns that number, right? So what you have to then do is use other criterion. I think in this case, the way that I would describe these players, just again, as an example, Roberto Clemente is probably the greatest legend that ever wore number 21. Tim Duncan is probably the most accomplished. Deion Sanders is, I think, beyond most question, the greatest player at his position ever. And by that measure, probably the cornerback by whom all other corners that have since come have been compared and probably will until the end of time. So you're forced to make excruciating decisions based upon as much science as you can. But ultimately, there's as much an art to this as there is a science. And in some cases, the longer, like the older a player you were, the longer your legend has endured, wound up being a tiebreaker for us in many cases. So we really canvassed more than a century of sports history in so doing.
Talking to Paul Hembikidis, talking about a new book he co-wrote. It's called Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. You could join in at 800-642-1234. And I know this is public radio, and sometimes you're a little shy about admitting that you're a sports fan. I know you're out there. Call in with your favorite sports player, the most important, the one you'd say, yeah, they own that number on their jersey. They're the greatest in that jersey of all time. Call in with your questions for our guest about how they made these choices, who got chosen, and were you lucky enough to see some of the legends who at least might be in the running play? Hank Aaron. We'll start naming names in a minute. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, other great Wisconsin legends. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Paul, I want to start naming names, and I want to start with the greatest player to ever play for the Eau Claire Bears, plus the Milwaukee Brewers and Atlanta Braves, Hank Aaron, number 44. And I think there's a really solid case that he should own number 44. Talk about that.
I think we could be playing sports for another 1,000 years, and Henry Aaron would still be the person that you would say owns the number 44. It is still, candidly, a crowded field. Willie McCovey and Reggie Jackson both wore number 44 from the game of baseball. Jerry West wore number 44 in his NBA career and his college career. Pete Maravich wore the number 44. Jim Brown wore the number 44 in college. I created lists like this for literally every single number, 1 through 100, you might imagine, because it was important to me, important to us, to canvas the world of sports, to not assume that we could possibly forget or miss anybody. But in the case of Henry Aaron, I mean, obviously, there are two numbers for which you strongly associate him. It's 44 and it's 755. Well, I guess, you know, he had to get to 715 before he got to 755. That would have been a much longer book. So in the absence of being able to go past the number 100, it was clear to me that 44 was where he belonged. You can make a very credible argument that Henry Aaron is, if not the most accomplished hitter that ever lived, perhaps the most productive hitter that ever lived. It is very likely that you talk to sports fans 100 years from now, and they will still consider him, and not Barry Bonds, the all-time record holder. I think 755 is a much more enduring number than 762 because of that. Parenthetically, the number of total bases that Henry Aaron accumulated throughout his career, there is a chasm between he and Albert Pujols, who ranks second on that list. I'm talking about seasons that Albert Pujols would still need to play at a high level in order to catch him. I mean, truthfully, Henry Aaron is in the very last sentence of greatest baseball player that ever lived. You could not possibly write a book like this without including Henry Aaron. When we were going through our list, 1 through 100, that was one of those numbers, even though there's some other great athletes to wear 44, that we moved lickety-split. It was Henry Aaron. His name was mentioned, and we moved on to number 45. That's how convinced we were that Henry Aaron owned the number 44.
You share some of the history in the book, too, and I knew about the death threats that came to him as he was pursuing Babe Ruth's championship as a black player. People weren't happy about this. One anecdote you share is about what looked like a hug from Hank Aaron's mom after he broke that record. The true story behind that?
Yes. She later admitted, I guess somewhat begrudgingly, that she was doing that in part to shield her son from the snipers. I mean, we are living at a time in which Henry Aaron is now considered baseball royalty. But the fact of the matter is, Henry Aaron encountered enormous obstacle and prejudice along the way. I mean, Bowie Kuhn, the commissioner of Major League Baseball, was not even in attendance. Henry Aaron's belief many years later was that Braves fans were somewhat reluctant to credit him with passing Babe Ruth. And fans around the country, in some cases, were fighting against him. He famously kept a lot of that hate mail. And amidst that torrent of hatred and bigotry, he stood above it all. He rose above it all. My favorite quote, I think, that Henry Aaron ever said in relation to that home run chase, despite all of that, is, "I don't want them to forget Babe Ruth. I just want them to remember me." Think about that and the kind of person you have to be for that to be your high-level takeaway after enduring all that he did.
Talking to Paul Hembikidis, content producer for ESPN's Get Up, co-author of the new book, Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. You can join in with your opinions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Is there a Wisconsin athlete who's on your greatest of all time list? We'll see if they're in contention to make it in this book of numbers. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Hembo Hembakidis with ESPN's Get Up and Greeny programs. He's co-author of the new book, Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who to you is the biggest legend in your sport of choice? The greatest achievement in sports history in Wisconsin and beyond? You can join in at 800-642-1234. If there's a number you associate with a star athlete, tell us about it. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Patrick is with us in Wausau. Patrick, hi.
Good afternoon.
What'd you want to bring up, Patrick?
I'd like to know who owns number 15. I think it should be Bart Starr.
It's a strong case, Patrick, to be made for Bart Starr. I think I got bad news for you, Hembo, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, we determined that Bart Starr does not own the number 15, though there is no question that a great case could be made and should be made in some cases for Bart Starr. Number 15 is challenging. So in the current game today, you have Patrick Mahomes, who I think one could reasonably argue is already on a Hall of Fame track, and is a player for whom 10 or 15 years from now, we might consider him one of the very greatest of all time. Obviously, Bart Starr's legend and career is etched in stone, playing quarterback for the Green Bay Packers, and is a legendary figure in the sport's history. What we also wanted to do, however, in creating this book was sort of make a composite of all sports, and which in that case, that includes things that are beyond just jersey numbers. It includes jersey numbers that are beyond just the four major sports. So as you might expect, you will find plenty of professional football and basketball and baseball and hockey players. What you should also know is that only 56 out of the 100 chapters are assigned jersey numbers, which is to say you'll find cases in which we've assigned a number to a record or to a year. So in other words, this has a little bit more diversity than maybe I've led on to believe. However, zooming out, what I would like to say is that it is our belief that Tim Tebow might well be the greatest college quarterback that ever lived. There are not many college football players in our book, but it is our belief that Tim Tebow and his legend at the University of Florida and winning multiple championships and winning the Heisman as an underclassman and then becoming a finalist on other occasions had a career in college, the gravity of which exceeded that of Bart Starr's in the NFL. Now, I'm on Wisconsin Public Radio right now. And so there is a really, really good chance that if you are within the sound of my voice, you strongly disagree with that. And you are allowed to disagree with that. However, it was our belief that Tim Tebow owns the number 15 based upon his legendary college career. And while Bart Starr makes an excellent case, and while Bart Starr was absolutely among our finalists and potentially even a runner-up, what we could not possibly do was make everyone happy. That's part of the fun. There are only 100 chapters. And so ultimately, as unsatisfying as it is to say on Wisconsin Public Radio, Tim Tebow for us owns the number 15.
Patrick, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Another one of those numbers I wanted to bring up that isn't a jersey number, Babe Didrikson at number 46, Olympic track and field athlete, golfer, like just all athletics all the time, inspirational to a number of girls growing up in athletics, including a daughter of mine, an athlete who wrote one of her big school reports on Babe Didrikson. Can you talk about her and her ownership of the number 46?
Absolutely. So again, I want to double back on one of the attributes of this book that I'm so proud of, and that is the inclusion of sports from a wide range, the inclusion of female athletes, for which you could not credibly do this book without. And it is my belief that Babe Didrikson might well be the greatest female athlete of all time, at least in the history of our country. If you're not familiar with her backstory, it's a fascinating one. But she ranked 10th. She ranked number 10 in Sports Century's retrospective, I guess now 23 years ago. And so even if you were to take into account some of the female athletes that have since come to pass, she is at the very, very top of that list. We assigned Babe Didrikson number 46. So she was an incredible Olympian. 1932 was her greatest year as an Olympian. But 1946 was her greatest year as a golfer. She was a legendary golfer, and it was exceedingly important for us to include her in addition to a number of other female athletes. And so ultimately, based upon her extraordinary resume and reputation, both as an Olympian, as a star in that world, and also then later in the world of golf, I mean, dominating multiple sports for a long period of time, she was a shoe-in for the book. The challenge was to find a good number for her because, of course, she did not compete in a team sport, at least not directly. And thus, we assigned 46 to her based upon her exploits in the year of 1946.
Talking to Hembo Hemakidis, the new book is Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. You can join in if there's a number you attach to a particular athlete, a jersey number or achievement number at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Paul, a very personal one for me. I grew up in the Detroit radio market. And the legend is I was named Rob after the guy from the Dick Van Dyke Show. Choice number two was Gordy. After Gordie Howe, Detroit Red Wings legend, was this an easy choice for you at number nine?
Yes, I think his body of work is I think almost incomparable when you consider how beloved Gordie Howe is both in that city and in the game of in the sport of hockey, but also the longevity with which he played. I mean, there are numbers that are in this book that I could not believe, and I'm someone who majors in this stuff every single day. That being said, while we did land on Gordie Howe at number nine, Greeny and I did a book signing yesterday for which someone had a very credible question and asked, how did you justify Gordie Howe over Ted Williams, the splendid splinter, a person who walks down the street and you say, there goes the greatest hitter that ever lived. First of all, no one in the world, I don't know a single person who's a bigger baseball fan than I am. Baseball is well represented in our book, and that I can assure you. But even so, it is my belief that Gordie Howe's legend and stature within his sport, frankly, is greater than Ted Williams and his stature within his. That was one for which it was obviously excruciating to choose. But in the end, Greeny and I did come to consensus. It is Gordie Howe and not Ted Williams that owns the number nine.
Back to our callers. Mitch is with us in West Allis. Mitch, hi.
Hi. I would like to nominate Dale Earnhardt, the Intimidator, for number three.
Mitch, thanks a lot for the call. Now, NASCAR is represented. You had Richard Petty, I think, and Jimmy Johnson, very justifiably. Dale Earnhardt, I didn't think intimidated his way into number three, though.
No, and that is because if this book had one chapter, it would be Babe Ruth at number three. I mean, who are we kidding? If you were to do a book here, a sports book, for which you were assigning who owns every number 1 through 100, you could not, in my judgment, you could not make a credible case that anyone could be number three except for Babe Ruth. It just cannot be done. Babe Ruth, I think, is on the very short list, along with Muhammad Ali and Tiger Woods and Michael Jordan, as the greatest athletes that our nation has ever produced. His cultural significance was enormous. His significance on the game of baseball, and it becoming something recognizable like what it is now. Like, without Babe Ruth, baseball might well have looked very different for the last 100 years. Babe Ruth retired, and the records that he set, especially in the power department, some of which have not been touched, and most of which were not touched for decades. Babe Ruth essentially rewrote baseball's record book and holds an enormous place in the American sporting landscape. There are two drivers in the book. Richard Petty owns number 43. Spoiler alert. Jimmy Johnson owns the number 48. Spoiler alert. But ultimately, this is about the numbers. And in my judgment, you cannot make a credible case for Dale Earnhardt over the Bambino.
Mitch, thanks a lot for that call. I want to look toward the future. Here in Wisconsin, we got Giannis Antetokounmpo. In the future, he might own number 34. I know, he's still playing. He's got a while to go. To get it, he has to beat out Walter Payton. What do you think about that debate of the future, Hembo?
So this was a challenge for us. One thing our book is fairly light on is current active athletes, and that's because, well, so much of these things are decided through the anthology of history, right? And so I think there is a very credible case to be made that by the time Giannis retires, he will be the number 34 in all of sports. But right now, that is a list that includes Walter Payton and Charles Barkley and Hakeem Olajuwon and David Ortiz. Might Giannis someday occupy that top spot? Absolutely. But the bottom line of it is he chose a number that is absolutely stacked and loaded, and he's still only 28 years old. One thing for which we were not comfortable doing, hence our Patrick Mahomes decision, was projecting. We were not comfortable making assumptions about what a player might become. That sort of defeats the purpose of the exercise. the ownership of a number is something that does take time to develop and then crystallize. And in this case, with Walter Payton running his entire career in Chicago, wearing the number 34, as you guys all unfortunately know, it was very difficult for us to make a case for Giannis or, frankly, anyone else aside from Sweetness.
I want to go to number one now. It was Ozzie Smith, legendary shortstop. You know, there's these rule changes in baseball now. I hear the name Ozzie Smith, the This Week in Baseball theme song from the 80s pops into my head when they had the montage of amazing defensive plays. That one, I love that choice because it's like a game of a different time that maybe with these new rules is going to come back, and we're going to see players making plays like that again with the ball in play more.
Baseball is now going to return to a time in which being athletic mattered way more than it did even 1 year ago. Baseball is going to now reward players with a wide variance of skill set. Baseball is no longer going to be a sport for which a game will be decided via home run derby. Now, I don't think baseball is going to be, say, totally unrecognizable. Although I suppose if you drop someone in today and you begun watching with a pitch clock, you might say to yourself, well, this is pretty unrecognizable. But a player like Ozzie Smith last year would not have been so valuable. This year would likely be eminently valuable because the ease with which you can steal bases now and the abolition of the shift has put a premium on middle infield defense. Well, who could do those things better than Ozzie Smith? He is inarguably the greatest infielder of all time. And by the way, he stole 580 bases. In our opinion, Ozzie Smith is a great way to kick off the book. He is on the very short list of the greatest shortstops of all time, obviously. And the Wizard of Oz and players like that didn't really have a place in baseball over the last 15, 20, 25 years. In all candor, my earnest hope, as someone who very much, as you can tell, enjoys the history of baseball, is that those kinds of players enjoy a renaissance with the rule changes.
Well, we can agree on that. And Hembo, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, bud.
That's Paul Hembo Hembakidis, content producer for ESPN, partner of Mike Greenberg on ESPN Radio's Greeny. We talked to him about a new book he's co-authored with Greenberg called Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. You can listen back to this conversation and anything you missed here on Central Time by looking through our archives. Those are on the WPR smartphone app and at WPR.org. While you're there, find coverage from WPR News, our latest podcasts, and stream the Ideas Network live. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Now I'd like to take a moment to courageously offer my regrets for certain events that may have happened. Rest assured, I'm not the sort of person who would do that sort of thing, and I'm very sorry to anyone who was oversensitive or foolish enough to misinterpret my actions or intentions in a negative light. Please know that my anguish over these events outweighs the impact on anyone who was harmed by those actions and who, when you think about it, probably had it coming. In closing, I express my willingness to put it all behind us by graciously accepting your forgiveness. Okay, that wasn't an actual apology for anything in particular. It was a demonstration of some lessons from our next guests, lessons in how not to do an apology. In their blog and in their new book, they say apologies are good, they're valuable, they help rebuild social ties if we do them better than I just did. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you find it difficult in your life to apologize and to phrase it the right way? What were you taught about apologizing growing up? How do you teach your kids about saying they're sorry? What's the best apology you've ever gotten? What's the worst? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Engel are the founders of the website Sorry Watch, which analyzes public apologies, and their new book is called Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. They're both authors and writers. Susan, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
And
Marjorie, that was a great apology.
I was going to say, Marjorie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. That was one of the worst apologies I've ever heard.
I was going to ask. I really tried. I drew real life lessons from your book. Marjorie, how does that stack up in the world of bad apologizing?
That was just gorgeously terrible. That hit just about every bad point other than I'm not perfect and I'm on a journey.
I am on a journey. It's true. Now, Susan, on a serious note, part of the point in tracking apologies and writing this book is you see a lot of benefits to good apologies. What do apologies do for us as people, as a society?
I think both as people and individuals and as a society, a good apology leaves us in better shape than we were in before. It not only heals relationships, but it leaves them stronger.
Marjorie, what led you and Susan into tracking apologies, both at SorryWatch.com and now with this new book?
We are both journalists and we love to research and we are longtime friends. And I used to live in San Francisco, where Susan still lives. And now I'm in New York, although I have lots of Wisconsin family. And when I moved, Susan had this great idea that we could collaborate on this subject that interested both of us. And so we started doing the blog in 2012. And then in 2016, I think apologies really came to people's attention and the forefront of more people's interest when we had a president who had an innovative new take on apologies and not apologizing. And then we thought we could go into some research and really explore the notion of why apologies can be really courageous, difficult, vulnerable, brave acts in a book. So we did a lot more research, and here we are.
And Susan, I wanted to ask about that. This idea sometimes that, well, I don't want to apologize because I don't want to admit wrongness. It makes me seem weak, maybe, if I apologize. Make the case for what Marjorie just said, that apologizing can be a sign of a certain strength.
Well, when you apologize, you make yourself vulnerable. You put yourself in a one-down position, something that we just instinctively avoid. But if you can push through that, actually apologize, you will look stronger. You will look more like a grown-up, more like a good person. And so ironically, if you go through and you let yourself look weak, you'll end up looking stronger.
Talking to Marjorie Engel and Susan McCarthy about their new book, Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. You can call in with your questions, your experiences with apologizing or lack of apologies. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll spend some time on bad apologies. But Marjorie, can you start us off with the basics of what the elements are in a good apology?
Yeah, we say that you can apologize really well in 6.5 easy steps. They're easy to say, but psychologically, they can be really hard to do. Number one is you use the words "I'm sorry" or "I apologize." You don't talk about regret as you did in your terrible apology in that opened the segment. Number two, you name the thing that you did. You have to say it. Number three is you show that you understand why what you did was bad and hurtful. Number four is don't make excuses, which is all too easy to do. You can explain what you need to explain, but be really careful not to turn that into making excuses. Number five is say what you're doing to ensure that this won't happen again. What steps are you taking? And number six is if you can make an offer of repair of some sort, which isn't always a possible thing to do, but if you can make reparations, do that. And the 6.5, the all important half step, is listen. Let the other person have their say.
Susan, how do we get ourselves in the right mindset? You know, I know when I make mistakes and offend other people or, you know, just harm people in my life, I get defensive, right? I don't want to admit that I'm a bad guy. How do I get myself from there to a position where like, well, wait, I did do something that, hurt somebody in my life. How do I get there?
Well, one thing that you can do is you can practice. You can practice on little things. Oh, I'm sorry. The salt is in the kitchen after all, and kind of get past the barrier of doing that. But one of the things that I think we're doing with the website is we give a lot of examples of bad apologies. In my research with learning, animal learning, in fact, I discovered that one of the ways that animals and people learn things is by watching others be taught. And so looking at bad examples of apologies, which we have lots of in the book, some of them pretty funny, is a really good way to learn how to do a good apology.
Marjorie, in the book, you share what the two of you view as a good apology. This is superstar Lizzo apologizing. She used the word spaz in one of her recent songs, a word used against people with disabilities often. Can you share some of that apology with us and why you found it was thought it was a successful one?
Yeah, it was interesting. Both Beyonce and Lizzo had both used this word that is a slur against people with disabilities. And I just like, Lizzo is just no nonsense. She went in, she got out, she didn't turn it all about this. I'll read it to you. This is from her Instagram. It's been brought to my attention that there is a harmful word in my new song, Girls. Let me make one thing clear. I never want to promote derogatory language. As a fat Black woman in America, I've had many hurtful words used against me. So I understand the power words can have, whether intentionally or in my case, unintentionally. I'm proud to say there's a new version of Girls with a lyric change. This is the result of me listening and taking action. As an influential artist, I'm dedicated to being part of the change I've been waiting to see in the world. XOXO, Lizzo. So, you know, it's a little bit self-aggrandizing, but you're allowed to do that when you are Lizzo. But, you know, the important thing here is she changed it before she even apologized, right? Like an apology isn't just empty words. It's taking action. And that's really the impressive thing that she did. And she wasn't defensive and she owned it.
Susan, where do people start to go wrong? Now, and let's not talk about celebrities here necessarily, but in our daily lives, what are some of the most common pitfalls when we try to apologize but don't hit some of those good notes?
Well, one of them is not even saying you're sorry, saying, I feel bad about that. And then there's a real temptation to go into how bad you feel. Oftentimes we summarize some of the bad apologies as sorry if, sorry but, sorry you. Sorry you is where you turn around and accuse the other person of being so annoying you had to do the bad thing.
Bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Ripon. Randy, hi.
Hi. I went through a 12-step program, actually several of them, and you know, I was a very active participant. I went through counseling and you know, the 12 steps make amends. Well, I tried to make sure I did that, and I you know, it wasn't near as bad of an experience I thought it was. But the flip side of that is, in recent years, I've had three people make these kind of, I call them fake apologies, you know, and your guest, you brought it up, you know, I'm sorry, but, or you this, or, and one fellow, I was sitting with my girlfriend and he came up to me to apologize. And then when he got done, he started walking away. He says, well, I don't know what I'm apologizing for, but I guess I'm sorry. And I turned to my girlfriend and said, well, he just took it all back. It would have been better if he would have said nothing. Yeah. You know?
Randy, I want to ask, in that 12-step program, this is, I think, something a lot of people have experience with. Like, when you did the step where you're making amends and making apologies, like, did you feel like, I'm ticking off a box here? Or did you come in with a sense like, hey, I did this person wrong, and I'm really taking a shot and making amends for it?
Oh, I felt horrible about the things, you know, but, you know, I think it's also, you need to be self-reflective and really do a really strong looking depth into, and putting yourself in the other person's shoes too. And I think that's really important. And it seems like the apologies I mentioned, they never once tried to put themselves in my shoes. And I just thought that's kind of an odd thing, you know.
I gotcha. Randy, thank you so much for sharing that. Marjorie, Randy gives us a lot to work with there. What do you think?
First of all, congrats to Randy for, you know, doing recovery and for having all of this really good insight into apologies. One of the things we point out is that not everyone is as good at the, you know, a lot of times when people begin a 12-step program, they're super excited to go out there and make amends and, you know, make a fearless moral inventory. And that often means apologizing without thinking about the really thinking about the impact of your apology on the other person. So if you're approaching someone who hasn't heard from you in 5 years and may have ended, your relationship may have ended poorly because of the, whatever drove you into recovery, think for a minute before you go off like a fire hose with your apologies. And it sounds like Randy really did that, that his he kept at top of mind the fact that apologies are about the other person. And then when someone says to you, I guess,
Thanks for sharing your experiences, Randy, on both sides of apologies. We're talking to Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Engel about their new book. It's called Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever gotten that apology that just made things worse? Have you gotten an apology that changed your life maybe for the better? Do you have difficulties apologizing, even when you know maybe you should? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Engel. Their new book is called Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies, chock full of advice on how to make a good apology and examples of how to make a bad one. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about apologizing? Are you good at it, or is it hard for you to do? If so, you are not alone. Have you ever gotten a good one or a bad one? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Pat is with us in Middleton. Pat, hi.
Hi. So on the infrequent occasion when I've had to call a company over something that wasn't quite right, in my estimation, it seems like there's this probably written by lawyers or risk managers type of reaction that I get, and I wonder if others do too, which seems like it's built to deflect liability and just simply say, it doesn't matter really what the issue is. I'm sorry you feel that way. And then we never get really to the what is the issue. It's more about how they're sorry, how I feel. It really is a why bother kind of conversation, and it, maybe that's the whole point. I don't know. But I was wondering what you think about that.
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. And Susan, you've got a whole chapter on corporate apologies and non-apologies in the book.
Yeah, I think Pat is really onto something. I think that they are reading from scripts. I have definitely had that experience myself. I remember once dealing with an airline where the perfectly nice person on the phone was apologizing repeatedly for the confusion. And there wasn't any confusion. It was a deliberate airline policy to try and get me to pay extra for my seats. But she just had to read over and over, sorry for the confusion, sorry for the confusion. And other times they'll say, you know, we wrote about a dental practice that kept saying, we're sorry you feel this way. Well, yeah, you know, my mouth won't close properly. And my other dentist says it's an outrage. So those are scripts that companies give to their employees who are forced to read them. They don't make people feel better. Like Pat, we can see right through it, and it doesn't get rid of liability.
Pat, thanks a lot.
Oh, go ahead. A poor apology is actually worse than no apology. And when people, you know, people are determined to believe that this isn't the case, but a 2006 study by the Harvard Hospital System looked at the fact that good apologies do not increase the risk of, say, malpractice suits. And there is so much evidence that bad apologies actually cause them. And some malpractice lawyers think that 2/3 of malpractice suits are actually because of the failure to take responsibility and apologize and communicate openly. And people get vindictive.
Thanks a lot for that call, Pat. Liz joins us now in Sister Bay. Liz, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I had a situation when my mother-in-law did something not only to hurt myself, but my place of business. And she admitted she had done it. And then you know, I expected an apology, and the apology was what you were just speaking about with the other guest. And she said, I am sorry you feel that way. But she did not say that she was sorry for what she had done or admit that it was wrong. And this was back in like 2021. And I'm just wondering, I still have problems like trying to let it go. And I'm just wondering how to move on.
Liz, thanks a lot for the call. Marjorie, first of all, in many situations, maybe where we should give an apology, you talk about this in the book. We don't see ourselves as the bad guy. We come up with reasons why we weren't wrong in the first place.
Right. Like, I'm sure your mother-in-law has decided that there were really good reasons that she did what she did. And again, as I just said, with, you know, on a corporate level, a bad apology is in so many ways worse and more hurtful than no apology. And I'm really sorry that that's what you got. I wonder, I don't know what the caller's relationship with her mother-in-law is like. I don't know if you have the kind of relationship where you can sit down and say, look, I'm still really hurting over what happened. And I would like to talk to you more about it. And I would like you to address, and then you say the X, Y, and Z. And, you know, you might want to do it in a letter because people often have a little more time to process and are a little less defensive when they have a little bit of distance rather than being cornered. But I don't think the caller should feel bad about feeling bad mm-hmm. because that's what a bad apology does.
Thanks for that call, Liz. We are talking to Marjorie Engel and Susan McCarthy about their new book, Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. Back to your calls now. Beth is with us in Mequon. Beth, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a dear, dear friend who was a friend for probably 30 years who got mad at me for I don't know why. She never would tell me. She stopped completely talking to me. I've tried calling. I've sent her letters. We 4 years ago, we moved out of the town that we lived in. Now, this week, her husband died, and I would really like to send her a sympathy card. I don't know if I should apologize again in that sympathy card. I don't even know if she'll read the sympathy card. I feel bad. I don't know what I did. How do you apologize for something you don't know what you did?
Beth, thanks for the call. Susan, any thoughts for Beth?
Beth, I really feel for you. That is so hard. I will say that I think it's appropriate to send her a sympathy card. And in the sympathy card, don't bring up the apology or the mystery about what the apology is supposed to be for. That would be a separate conversation, which you may or may not be able to have. So I would send a sympathy card, you know, with, you know, maybe some memories of her late husband. And then if you can still try in a separate conversation to say, you know, I really feel bad that we're estranged and I feel like I did something, but I don't know what it is. Can you help me figure it out?
Beth, thanks a lot for the call and good luck. Alicia joins us now in Milwaukee. Alicia, hi.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up, Alicia?
I just wanted to say that I'm in retail pharmacy, and a lot of times people come to the pharmacy after maybe getting a not-so-good diagnosis, pretty bad news, and maybe feeling sad and sometimes angry, and they blow up because one prescription may be there and not another that the doctor said that they would send, or maybe there's something wrong with the prescription, so I have the prescription itself, but there's a problem with it. And so people get very angry, and I have had people call after they leave the pharmacy, call back and apologize. So I just wanted to say that those apologies do mean the world.
Alicia, thanks a lot for the call. And Marjorie, that takes us to a good point to end on. Leave us with some hope for what we can do with a good apology.
A good apology can mend fences. It can strengthen relationships. We have a post on our website about kintsugi, the Japanese art of fixing cracks with glue and gold. And a thing becomes stronger. The cracks don't disappear, but the thing is stronger and more beautiful after a fracture.
Marjorie, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Susan, thanks for being with us.
You bet. That was great.
Been talking to Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Engel, founders of the website Sorry Watch. They joined us to talk about their new book, Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. A while back, I talked to the author of a book about the Titanic and efforts to find and analyze its remains, plus a look at other shipwrecks and the people who look for them. And a lot of you called in. It turns out there's a lot of interest and curiosity when it comes to shipwrecks and the Titanic in particular. So I wanted to make sure everybody saw the news out there. This came out last week. An amazing 3D imaging project scanned the wreck of the Titanic and put out this amazingly detailed vision of the remains. The project was led by a deep sea mapping company and a documentary team. They used remote control submersible cameras with over 200 hours of footage, then used those images to create this 3D rendering of the Titanic as it is now. You can look at the hull of the ship, tour inside as though it wasn't filled with water. The images are pretty amazing, and researchers hope they'll answer some still open questions about what exactly happened to the ship. You can search this up on the BBC website. They have a video tour, and you can hear a Central Time interview about the Titanic. Search for Titanic at WPR.org. This is Central Time.